Not a week goes by without major breaking news in our region, in our state, and in our nation. From Kentucky pension reform to Confederate statues in Lexington to the opioid crisis across the nation, as well as in Kentucky, there's a lot going on. And what about the breaking story of Thursday morning regarding allegations against Kentucky House Speaker Jeff Hoover? We have a round table full of reporters ready to discuss the latest news on this week's Eastern Standard, and we're inviting you to be part of the conversation. Send us an email right now, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. In just a few minutes, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, a reporter's roundtable this week, right after the news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen, and this week, a reporter's roundtable. We have a very full table this morning of reporters who are here to discuss the latest news in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, in our region of Central Kentucky, as well as other news that may be having an impact on our area. And I want to welcome to the studio. Actually, let's start with our new guest. For the first time, we are welcoming Beth Musgrave. Beth is reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader. Beth currently covers Lexington city government and development for the Lexington Herald Leader. Prior to covering City Hall, she covered state government in Frankfort for 6 years. She's worked for newspapers in Indiana, Mississippi, Washington, D.C., and Illinois. Beth, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here, and we are going to pick up on, of course, the latest stories from Lexington and Fayette County in just a few minutes on today's Eastern Standard. Also with us, old friends who've been here, I guess I shouldn't use such adjectives around folks. All of us are getting
older.
Some of
us are old.
We're getting a little old. What's that?
Some of us are old.
Some of us are old, yes. And first up is Adam, the wisecracker is Adam Beam, Associated Press reporter, Kentucky State House reporter. Adam is a South Carolina native. Adam worked for nearly a decade at the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, before moving to Kentucky in 2014. Actually, you were in Texas for a little while.
No, just South Carolina and then here.
Where did I get the Texas thing?
I'm not sure.
I'm making a connection.
Great state, Texas.
Okay, sorry about that. Well, all right, a shout out to our friends in Texas. Also with us, Ronnie Ellis. And Ronnie is capital correspondent for CNHI News. CNHI is the owner and publisher of the Richmond Register. And how many other papers in the state?
Well, there are 11 of us, 11 of them in all in Kentucky.
All right. And finally with us, Ryland Barton. And Ryland, there's the Texas connection.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Ryland. Ryland is state capital reporter. Ryland, state house reporter for Kentucky Public Radio. He's covered politics and state government for NPR member stations at KWBU in Waco and KUT in Austin. And Ryland has been reporting here in Kentucky, is it 5 or 6 years now?
It's about 3 years now.
About three.
Yeah.
Well, we're grateful for all of you being here in the studio. Let me let our listeners know this is an interactive program. After all those long introductions, please feel free to get on board. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest or call, and we'll go ahead and open the lines and let you know that you will you may be waiting for a little bit, but feel free to get on the line at 800-621-8890. Let's start the conversation with news of the day. We woke up to news that was broken, I guess, by the Louisville Courier-Journal. And I don't know if this was an extensive investigative report that they had done or just something they had come upon, but it's a story that says Kentucky House Speaker Jeff Hoover has paid off someone who made sexual harassment allegations against him. And that's a relatively recent occurrence. I guess the payoff or the settlement was last week or so. Who has information you'd like to share with us on that?
Well, I can't speak to the sources that the CJ used because I don't know who the sources that they relied on. But I can speak to the journalist that wrote the story. Debbie Yetter is one of the finest reporters in the state. She's got a great reputation. So, you know, if she reports it, I think that adds some heft, I guess, behind the report. But I will say that regardless of the sourcing and but the fact that the story is out is the worst possible timing for Republicans because they're trying to get this pension bill passed. It's very controversial. There was a rally last night at the State House where hundreds of state workers from across the state showed up for 2 hours in the rain, holding signs, chanting. There's a lot of pressure being put on lawmakers all over the state. And Jeff Hoover, the speaker, is, along with Governor Bevin and President, Senate President Robert Stivers, is the guy that has to shepherd this through. And the Senate has the votes. We know that from the leadership there. The House does not have the votes. And that's Hoover's job, to get the votes. And anything that undermines that would be a blow. The fallout is yet to be seen since this story is so new. But, you know, we could find out more tomorrow. There's supposed to be a caucus meeting of the Republican membership of the House at 2 o'clock in Frankfort tomorrow. That'll be closed to the public. But whatever emerges from that meeting will probably have a great impact on the future of this bill, because they could come out and united front and say they support the speaker all the way, or there could be some factions. They could try to force him out. Who knows?
Jeff Hoover is a highly respected lawmaker, respected by Democrats as well as Republicans, a very pleasant personality, a guy who's able to get along with a lot of people. I assume he does. He's good at negotiating behind the scenes.
Well, I think that description certainly has been true of Speaker Hoover up until this point. He is well regarded across the aisle and among the membership. This, as Adam said, is really going to complicate the political dynamics of the pension bill. Speaker Hoover told me, or told us only yesterday, that he would not make a vote on the pension bill a loyalty vote for his caucus. He would allow each individual member to vote his conscience. That may not and probably didn't please the administration and the backers of the bill. So there is the idea that perhaps he wasn't pushing this hard enough. And if there is a change in his status, how does that affect the standing of the pension bill? It's been my belief or observation that the portion of the House Republican caucus that has the most reluctance to vote for the bill is also that portion of the caucus which heretofore has been most supportive of Hoover as the speaker. So this really muddies the water, and I really don't have any forecast on how it may play out.
Rylan Barton, you filed the story for us that we've been airing this morning on the rally at the Capitol last night. Tell us more about that.
As Adam mentioned, there are hundreds of state employees, a lot of teachers who showed up to the Capitol last night through the rain, chanting, holding up signs. And this is just kind of the outcropping of a lot of the pushback that we've been hearing over the last week or two since the framework for this pension bill was released. State employees aren't happy with it. The bill would, it moves nearly all future and most and some current state employees onto 401k style plans. Teacher or state employees, including teachers who reach 27 years of service, would be their benefits would be capped, and they'd also be moved into 401ks after that point or transitioned into 401k plans. So there's been a lot of pushback, and as Ronnie was saying, there's a lot of Republican lawmakers as well who have been a little bit wary of the of some of the provisions in this bill, especially from these rural areas where the public school system and state government is often the largest employer in these areas, and so there's a lot of pressure from these people who are a little worried that they're going to have fewer benefits and their retirement checks aren't going to be as large in the future.
And I think one of the biggest sticking points that emerged yesterday was this proposal to basically give a 3% pay cut to all state workers, including teachers. And the way this was presented is, we're going to take 3% from your paycheck and put it in the retirement health care fund to pay for the health coverage, basically.
That's into a general fund of some sort, not into individual account.
It pays for retirement health coverage. And retiree health coverage is separate from the pension check you get. And it's not covered by the inviolable contract. It's just something that the state offers. They offer health care coverage for people who retire. Well, the Speaker Hoover and Senate Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer yesterday told reporters that, you know, the purpose of that 3% cut was not to really boost and add more money to that fund. The fund is going to have the same level of funding in it regardless. But the point of doing it was to save the state money, because instead of the state using taxpayer dollars to pay that 3%, they're going to shift that burden to the state workers. And that's something that the state workers are really upset about. I interviewed a guy last night named Joe Cope. He's a high school English teacher from Rockcastle County, and he drove about 80 miles to stand at that rally, he said, because, you know, he makes in the $40,000 range a year. And when you make that much money, cutting 3% is a big deal. He said, you know, you're trying to pay for a house and two cars, and you're going to have a 3% cut. It's really hard for them to understand that. And Speaker Hoover mentioned last night that's one of the things they're looking at. But eliminating that 3% cut is really difficult because it would basically cost the state money and could require more severe budget cuts in the future.
And we're talking two retirement systems, right? KTRS and KRS?
Right, right. But the 3% cut would be across all systems, basically.
Now, these are, correct me if I'm wrong, defined benefit plans? Is that what they're called?
The existing plan is called a defined benefit. Basically, the state guarantees you a benefit based upon your salary and service through the years.
And is it a multiple of the number of years, and there's a percent applied to that?
Correct. Mm-hmm. But what they're talking about doing, there is a group of state employees currently employed after January 1, 2014, that are in what are called a cash hybrid plan. It's kind of a mix. But what this proposal would do would move everyone newly hired to a mandatory defined contribution plan, where the risk is shifted from the employer to the employee. Existing employees and teachers after 27 years, anything above that would also be through a defined contribution plan. There's a three-year window for current teachers, but other than that, it's 27 years.
What do we know about the shortfall at this point? I know that number shifts depending on who is reporting it.
It's at least $33 billion. That's according
billion with a B.
That's across all systems. Some are better off than others. Some are a lot worse than others. But if across all eight systems, it's at least that much. That's how much the actuarial valuation is. Now, the governor and some others prefer a number that's much higher, because the way that this is kind of an estimate. You're going out, how much money do we need to pay these retirement benefits over the next 30 years? And based on the assumptions that you use, how long will people live? You know, how much money will the state make on its investments? How much will the state's employment workforce grow or shrink? Based on those numbers, the number can grow or not. Now, the governor thinks it's as high as $80 billion, but it's at least $33 billion.
Actually, Ronnie, hold on here. We're going to take a short break. This is a Reporters Roundtable. We have with us Adam Beam, the voice you just heard a few moments ago. Ronnie Ellis is here with us, Ryland Barton and Beth Musgrave. And, Beth, we are going to certainly get your take. If you have a take on the pension system and its effect on Fayette County and Lexington Fayette Urban County Government, we're talking about pension reform. We're talking about issues related to the upcoming General Assembly. We're talking about the story that came out about House Speaker Jeff Hoover just this morning on Thursday. We're going to talk about Lexington, Fayette County issues, the opioid crisis. What's on your mind? What do you want to know more about? What do you feel reporters should be reporting more about? 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, a Reporters Roundtable this week, and we have a full table, and we'd love to have a full phone bank if you have questions, comments, or something you'd like to share with our reporters. In the studio at WEKU this morning is Ronnie Ellis of CNHI Newspapers, Ryland Barton, Kentucky Public Radio, Beth Musgrave of the Lexington Herald Leader and Kentucky.com, and Adam Beam of the Associated Press. And we started off talking about the news that came out this morning about a report from the Louisville Courier-Journal saying that Kentucky House Speaker Jeff Hoover settled with a woman who had made a sexual harassment allegation against him, and that's a relatively recent news. Could be It's going to be a developing story as the day goes by, and you're hearing some of the very people who are going to be right in the center of coverage of that story. So we're really grateful that they were able to make the time to be with us this morning. We're going to talk about Lexington, Fayette County issues, the opioid crisis, and other major stories that are on your mind. Feel free to be part of our conversation today at 800-621-8890. And Ronnie Ellis, I know you wanted to chime in on what Adam had just said.
Well, it's just that I get asked all the time, why such wide variation on the assumed unfunded liabilities from $33 to $80 billion. And there are a whole host of actuarial assumptions, numbers of workers, numbers of retirees, payroll growth, so forth, that go into that. But the key one is your assumed rate of return on your investments. And at 7.75%, which is what they have been using up until about a year ago, that unfunded liability would be about 33. If you knock it down to 6%, which is what they've done recently, it's about 40 billion with a B. When you get to the 80, Governor Bevin is using the U.S. Treasury note, which is down about 2.53%. That's how you get to the 80. You know, no one really knows for sure what that is.
And current retirees, should they be confident they are going to continue receiving their retirement benefits that they have been receiving for perhaps a number of years, a decade, 15, 20 years in some cases?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, states can't declare bankruptcy like cities can. I mean, you look at Detroit and some of these other places that when they get in trouble, they declare bankruptcy and kind of work out a deal. But that's never happened.
The federal government prints money.
Right. And that's never happened at the state level, so nobody knows. If those plans were to fail, it would be like the World Series of tax and law lawyers. it would be a huge case, and nobody really knows. I think a lot of the governor and some of the legislative leaders said yesterday that at least the Kentucky employees retirement system, which is the worst funded that we have, is about 5 years away of running out of money. Other people think that's not true, but it's very clear that it's a dire situation. That's for sure.
Let's turn to Beth Musgrave. Beth is a reporter, City Hall primarily, for the Lexington Herald Leader. You might want to grab that mic and get a little bit more aimed in your direction. We're sharing microphones this morning because we had such a crowd in the studio. But first of all, reaction to the pension system. I assume there are plenty of folks in Fayette County who are concerned about this, the second largest city in the state, of course.
Yeah, it's not just Lexington. It's all cities and counties. They don't know yet what their obligation's going to be, and that's a key constituency for all these state legislators. That's some of the pushback's going to be. So Lexington, for example, earlier this year got a prediction that their payment would increase by about $10 million. So they're currently at 19, so it would push it all the way up to 20. The school systems are another. It's not just the teachers, it's also how much the school systems have to pay in. Fayette County school systems would go from like 10 to 15 million. But when you're looking at a budget of 357 million, that's a big, big increase. They've seen other numbers that are like 18 million for next year. And then they've got the opioid crisis. So, and that's hitting cities and counties hardest. They're the ones that are paying a lot for it. So all cities and counties right now are really struggling, and they feel like we paid into this system. The state didn't, and yet we're the ones that are going to have to pay a huge increase into the pension system.
Haven't there been discussions in Lexington Council about the pension issue and concerns?
Been a lot of concerns about it because for all cities and counties, really, not just Lexington, they don't know what the number's going to be, and everybody's looking at their budget right now. And so they don't know what that number's. It could be $10 million. It could be $18 million. And they have a ton of, like I said, they're putting on more like ambulances right now because they have so many overdoses. That costs a lot of money. And for smaller cities, Lexington has an unemployment rate of 3%, which is almost full employment, But a smaller city, Eastern Kentucky, which has no or has lost a lot of their job base, and that's where cities come up with their taxes. You know, I don't know how they're going to afford a steep increase in their payment into the system.
I do want, yes, Ronnie, I want to get into the Lexington, Fayette, and urban county issues, as well as Confederate statues and so forth. But there are a few more issues, a few more questions related to the pension system.
Well, I was just going to point out that there's something like 14 or 15 school districts across the state that are already on a watch list because they're unable to maintain the required level of a contingency fund. This is going to put an enormous burden on a lot of those school districts.
What do you all know? And before we go into this the other Lexington issues, there's talk among the higher education community, the universities, about perhaps establishing their own retirement system.
Well, they definitely want to get out as much as they can. I think there's a lawsuit right now with Western Kentucky University. They basically, I might get some of the details wrong, I think they fired pretty much all of their like maintenance workers and then rehired them back with this third-party contractor. And so now that they still get to keep their jobs, they just don't technically work for the university anymore. And so the university says, oh, we don't have to pay pension contributions for them anymore.
That's happened a little bit closer to home here in Richmond as well.
Oh, really? So the pension system sued because they say you can't just take all these people out and not, you know, pay their fair share. So that's going to have to be taken up in the courts. But I think it's not just universities. I think local governments and everybody, they're really frustrated with how much money they're having to pay. And they want to, you know, a lot of these people want to get out if they can.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I tend to be sympathetic to the universities. The state cuts funding to the universities and tells them to do more with less. So they look for savings, and one of the ways they found savings was to contract for some of these janitorial and custodial services. And, of course, that takes money out of the retirement system. And the state turns around and sues them because they did what the state asked them to do with less money.
Well, and the other issue is that it's almost like a pass-through in terms of a tax increase. So right now there's no – there's no revenue increase in this bill in terms of they're not putting any new money in. But if you think about it, if the school system that's already cash strapped has a huge bump in their bill, they're going to have to raise their property taxes. So they're making the locals raise the taxes.
There has to be additional funding somewhere.
Yeah.
Beth Musgrave is here with us from the Lexington Herald Leader, and we do want to turn to another major issue that's been in the news of recent weeks, kind of quieted down for 3 or 4 weeks or so, but the Confederate statues in Lexington was a major issue, and I'm sure it's still on the minds of many people in the area. What do we know about the current status? Those statues that had been in place for, 100 years or so in front of the old historic courthouse in downtown Lexington are apparently now in storage?
Yes. So they had originally thought that those statues were under the control of the Military Heritage Commission, which a mayor in 2003 had signed some paperwork and said and put them under the commission's control. But that paperwork and the release of those statues to that commission was never approved by the city council. So the attorney general issued an opinion and said, nope, the commission doesn't have control of the statues. You can do what you want with them. And because that's been a key sticking point, is that the commission would have to say or has to okay where they could be moved. It was mid-October when the attorney general's opinion, and then they took those statues right then.
The opinion was issued in the afternoon or early
in
the day.
And they were gone that night. They were gone that night. And obviously there's a lot of concern because of what happened in Charlottesville. And, you know, several white nationalist groups had said they would come to Lexington to protest, you know, moving of the statues. So they did it very quickly. They're currently in storage. The plan is to put them at the Lexington Cemetery. It's John C. Breckinridge and John Hunt Morgan. They're buried at the Lexington Cemetery, but they're still working out the deal. There's the cemetery wants money for upkeep. They want it for security. There's security issues. There's also issues. They're really large. They're really large statues. And so they are also concerned about the basically the base. The base is huge. So they're still working. The mayor has said that his plan currently is to put it at the cemetery. So,
Beth, what kind of reaction have you had about Mayor Jim Gray's role in that whole process? I guess he, that day, made pretty much a unilateral decision to move the statues?
Yes. I mean, the council was informed of it in a closed session. I got their blessing. But I think that they just really felt like I think their argument is public safety, that it was best just to move them right away before there could be any mobilization of any particular group. So,
well, the political question that occurs to me about that is I think that's probably a popular decision in Lexington. But Mayor Gray, of course, is still rumored to be considering a run for the 6th District, and I wonder what the popularity of that decision might be in the other 18 counties, or at least some of them.
But then there's the other issue of, if you're trying to get national money for a congressional race on the national front, that's probably going to look pretty good to donors. So it depends on your constituency and who you're trying to please.
Prior to the show, we did have one email from listener Jacob, who wrote in. And Jacob wrote, as a person who has grown up with an admiration of U.S. history and as a person who has personally visited all 61 Civil War monuments in the state of Kentucky, it disheartens me to see the rich history of our state being denigrated and ultimately rewritten by people who have little interest in truly learning other than to cherry-pick a few talking points for their agenda. I have talked to some of the members of one of the groups that has been advocating to take down the monuments for years. None of them even knew, for example, that John C. Breckinridge, whose monument was taken down, was actually the 14th vice president and the youngest in our nation's history, or that he ran against Lincoln for president in 1860. Breckinridge also represented Kentucky in the House and the Senate for many years until he was thrown out of the Senate by Lincoln, and he even fought for the U.S. in the Mexican-American War. He bears remembrance for more than just his role in the Confederacy. Many opponents of the John Hunt Morgan statue claim it was placed at Cheapside specifically to be placed on what was a slave block, to be a racist symbol. His statue was actually placed there for historic reasons. Morgan captured two companies of the 4th Ohio Cavalry at the courthouse and at the hotel across the street. The Lexington mayor begged him not to burn the courthouse down and convinced the Union commanders to surrender. Because of Morgan's love for Lexington, he spared the courthouse. That is why his statue was placed in front of the courthouse. Jacob wrote much more material than that, but I thought those are some major points that we should share. Reactions to Jacob's comment?
Well, this whole notion that you're destroying history, I think a lot of people say, look, you're not destroying it. It's just a matter of what you decide to put on a pedestal and an honor. And basically, those two men were the only people on pedestals in downtown Lexington. Both fought for the Confederacy, and they both fought to keep slavery. So do you want to put those people in a place of honor, I think was the... And I don't think anybody says that they didn't do good things. But there's also some of the things that Jacob just wrote are actually factually incorrect, too. So there has always been...
For instance, can you correct a couple of those facts?
Well, he said that Breckinridge was kicked out by Lincoln, and he was actually... It was a vote. It wasn't Lincoln that kicked Breckinridge out. Breckinridge also, after the Civil War, left the country because he didn't want to be charged with treason. So, and some of the stuff about John Hunt Morgan, I mean, John Hunt Morgan at the time, at the end of the Civil War, was essentially about to go on trial for the Confederacy was about to kick him out. You know, so I mean, it depends. History, I think, sometimes, and who's good and who's bad is sort of in the eye of the beholder.
I wanted to mention too that a lot of historians, including some at the Kentucky Historical Society, point out that when a lot of these statues were put in place, it came at the height of the Jim Crow era, and this was basically an attempt to kind of you know, memorialize the South in that way, as a reminder that these people were in control. I'll give you an example. He was talking specifically about the Jefferson Davis statue in the Capitol Rotunda. And, of course, the Daughters of the Confederacy, you know, raised private funds in addition with some public money to put that statue in place. And this historian, state historian, was telling the Historic Properties Advisory Commission that the original plan was to have the Jefferson Davis statue back-to-back with the Abraham Lincoln statue in the rotunda. And Lincoln would be pointing north, and Davis would be pointing facing south. And it was to be this kind of symbolic division. And, you know, the historian said in this meeting that it was very much – putting that statue was very much an opposition to Lincoln. There was a Lincoln statue, and they wanted to have this counterweight. And I felt like a lot of people feel like some of those reasons of why the statues were put up were not, you know, the best reasons in the first place.
What about the plaque on the Jefferson Davis statue? Anyone have some reaction about that? The latest news is where that plaque is going to be modified. That's sure. Been there.
A committee ended up, this Historical Properties Advisory Commission ended up voting to remove a plaque from the Jefferson Davis statue that said Patriot Hero Statesman. And their rationale is that they consider it to be – it's subjective. Not all people consider Jefferson Davis to be, I guess, say, a patriot or a hero. You know, this is coming after a couple years of there's been, you know, rallies and great opposition to the Jefferson Davis statue being in the Capitol Rotunda. First started in the wake of the there was a massacre in a church in Charleston, summer of 2015, was it? And and it looked like, you know, there were a bunch of people who wanted to remove the statue at that time. The commission ended up voting to not remove it then. And, you know, recently this year of, you know, protests and lots of discussion in Charlottesville and a lot of this more discussion of these statues, it kind of reignited that conversation. But it doesn't seem like the commission's interested or considering removing the statue, and so the plaque is the only thing that got removed this time around.
And they haven't removed it yet. It's still there, and I checked with the Historic Properties Advisory Commission this week. They said basically they're doing one last check with their legal department just to make sure that nobody else has a claim on this thing. But, you know, even if they do remove it, they're not going to destroy it. They're going to keep it and preserve the plaque so they can always put it back, I guess, if a lawsuit is filed or something.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Time for another brief pause, and we're going to ask you to get on board. If you have a question, a comment, a story you'd like to hear more about from our reporters. Reporters Roundtable this week, Adam Beam is here, Beth Musgrave, Ryland Barton, and Ronnie Ellis. And you're welcome to join in. 800-621-8890. Send an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or a tweet at wekuest. I don't know if Ed from Versailles is still on the line. Do we know that he's still there? If so, we will go to him in just a few moments. Again, 800-621-8890. Statewide issues, Lexington, Fayette, Central Kentucky issues. What about your community? If you're in Hazard, Pineville, Corbin, or elsewhere, please feel free to jump on board. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, a reporter's roundtable, and we're interested in hearing from you. As always, it's an interactive program, 800-621-8890. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or send an email, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Other issues, of course, in the news. The opioid crisis is in the news. Kentucky is very much in the center of that national issue. I'm not sure how much of a debate there is. The president has made a declaration that it is a national emergency. We'd be interested in hearing reactions to what the president has promised or what the administration has promised and what you're seeing in terms of action to battle the opioid emergency or opioid crisis here in Kentucky. And, of course, anything else we have discussed this morning or other stories that are in the news this morning. Let's go ahead and punch up line four and talk to Ed from Versailles. And, Ed, you are on the air. Go right ahead. Are you there, Ed? Apparently not. Okay. All right. Feel free to call back, and we may have had a technical issue there. 800-621-8890. 800-621-8890. Sorry for keeping you waiting so long there, Ed. 800-621-8890. Of course, there's a line open for you. We have a number of lines open this morning. Any other reactions to the Confederate statues and Jefferson Davis? Let's talk about the opioid crisis. You all involved in covering the opioid crisis, and to what extent? And what are your reactions to the president's declaration of a national emergency?
Well, I think a lot of the advocates were a little disappointed because the declaration doesn't really have a lot of teeth with it, because it doesn't include an increase in funding. Eric Hargan, who's the acting Health and Human Services Secretary, he took Tom Price's place after he resigned. He actually came to Lexington last week, the day after the president announced this this opioid crisis, this public health emergency. And, you know, he toured a clinic where that specializes in treating pregnant women who are addicted to opioids. And he had a private meeting with a lot of doctors and patients and advocates. And they all told him in that meeting that we need more money. We need resources to be able to provide these services. And, I think he was receptive to that. But, you know, there's been no, you know, well, there's been a lot. Congress has spent some money. You know, there was a bill passed last year that authorized, I think, about $1 billion in drug treatment programs for all across the country. But as far as this declaration, I think some people were a little disappointed. But it does do some things. For instance, it expands access to telemedicine. So in theory, these doctors could provide maybe prescribe some medically assisted treatments to people who are struggling with opioids remotely. It's unclear if that's going to be allowed to happen because there's some DEA rules against that.
And I know very much at the center of the president's declaration is a national, he called it an advertising campaign. I'm assuming it more likely to be a public service campaign, a campaign to talk about the dangers of drug usage. And, of course, I think of Nancy Reagan when that all comes up, and Just Say No. And you all know anything about reaction to that?
Well, going on with what Adam was talking about, you know, the cities and counties in particular, they're the ones that are really need funding now for a host of different things. And they're really struggling. Like in Lexington, like I said, they had to add another ambulance unit because the call volume has increased by 15% from last year alone. Now, some of that's because the population's aging, but they can, I mean, I sit by a police scanner, and it's sometimes 2 and 3, sometimes 4 a day. So there's those costs, and then nearly every city and county and public health department right now is struggling to pay for Narcan or Naloxone, which is an opioid reversal drug. And it's really, really difficult to find funding for that. And so, yes, PSAs are important, but I think from the front lines, they'd say they would like more money for just to pay for personnel, to pay for Naloxone, to pay for more local efforts to deter, drug abuse and drug addiction.
And the whole needle exchange issue is one that has been debated, I guess. And Lexington has a needle exchange program in place, and many other communities in place. That, I guess, that's unrelated, or it's related, but not exactly the same issue as the opioid crisis. We're talking about the possibility of spreading infection, HIV, and so forth.
Right, and those too need funding. I mean, and they often are running on a shoestring budget. And it's interesting because at first it was just Lexington and Louisville that put their health departments, and then now they're pretty, I wouldn't say common, but many counties now have needle exchange programs because obviously in southern Indiana they had a huge problem with the increase in HIV and AIDS. And so from a public health standpoint, it's much cheaper. The argument is it's much cheaper to do needle exchange than pay for HIV AIDS treatment.
I wanted to say just one thing about the advertising campaigns. I mean, there's been multiple federal studies that show that a lot of those campaigns, while, I mean, it's important, you want to tell people not to do drugs, but that they're not as effective as people would like.
And NPR just had a report yesterday.
Right, and there's even evidence that these massive campaigns actually can increase drug use because it basically kind of puts it in people's minds and they get out there and start using it.
Let's go ahead and see if we can get Ed from Versailles on the air. Ed, thank you for making the effort to call back. Are you there, Ed? Can you hear
me? Good morning. I have a very controversial question. We know that the governor is very anti-abortion and uses all of the power he has as the governor to reduce abortion clinics. But the question I have is for the reporters. We know that many of those abortions are to mothers with drug addiction problems, with that are single parents. And the downstream cost of these abortion decisions by the governor, when long after he's gone, we are going to have a bunch of babies that are damaged that will require extensive medical care. A lot of the mothers, because they don't have job skills, we will be supporting them with welfare. And Kentucky has the highest rate, or at least did a year or so ago, of child deaths due to abuse, many cases by boyfriends, and we are cutting social services. How come the reporters don't report on the downside or the long-term cost of the abortion concept?
Okay, Ed, thank you for asking that question. We'll ask the reporters about that. Where shall we pick up? With Ryland Barton first from Kentucky Public Radio. I'll put you on the hot seat.
And certainly the governor's he's made a concerted effort to, you know, he's been in these licensure battles with abortion clinics in Kentucky, and, you know, right now we're in the midst of a battle over, you know, whether the last abortion clinic in Kentucky can stay open. It's in federal court, and we should be hearing something about that in coming months or so. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made. The people who are supporting, pro-abortion groups, there are lots of arguments to be made about, you know, I mean, first of all, that these women want to be able to make a choice of what they feel is best for their own personal decisions, best for their family decisions. I think that, you know, as far as reporting coverage of it, I think that we're, you know, we're trying to include that side of the story as much as we can. But yeah, I mean, a lot of these fights are being played out in court right now. These are, frankly, a lot of the decisions that the judges are weighing right now. You know, when it comes down to whether or not, you know, women have or whether the judges are weighing in on whether the state is impeding on women's right to have a safe and legal abortion.
And abortion is not very readily available in Kentucky at this stage. Why, no, there's one clinic remaining.
Yeah, the only place you can get an abortion in Kentucky is in Louisville. And that's down from, I guess for a moment, there was three in late 2015.
We started off with a joke today about the old reporter, and that I enjoy that, or don't enjoy that.
I apologize. We're of the same generation, and probably within months of each other, my brother.
But that also allows me, you know, sometimes in my old age, to say things that maybe I wouldn't have been willing to say when I was younger. And let me defend the press a little bit on this and other subjects, but this one as well. There has been extensive coverage of this issue by the Courier-Journal and by the Herald-Leader and by the Associated Press. Debbie Yetter, who we talked about earlier, I believe Ms. Musgrave herself, have written about this article. There was, of course, the celebrated case that went on for years that those two newspapers and the Todd County Standard, a small weekly paper in southern Kentucky, challenged the Cabinet for Health and Family Services over child abuse, and through their efforts and the efforts of John Fleischaker and others, the attorney, they got those records released. A lot of issues that I hear a lot, and beyond this one as well, I hear a lot of complaints from the public about, well, the press doesn't cover. And I always want to ask them, well, how is it, since you're not in that field, that specific field, how did you learn about that? And invariably, of course, they learned about it through press reports.
And, you know, I would suggest also that folks who think a story is not being covered very well make contact with a reporter. Talk to a newsroom. Talk to an assignment editor at a TV station. Talk to a Ronnie Ellis or a Beth Musgrave and discuss with them. And you've got something that they don't know. You're always looking for tips, are you not?
Absolutely.
Let's go ahead. Let's go back to the phone and talk to Michael from Pikeville. We like to include the entire range of our listening area from Eastern Kentucky. Michael, thank you so much. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Thank you. My comment is on the, well, I have a couple of comments. One is on the historical monuments, the statues. History is like truth. Neither are objective. If you objectify truth, you make it opinion, not truth. And you cannot objectify history, and I don't think we should bow down to the political correctness of hurt feelings by one group or another to try to objectify the truth of history. We should never try to remove our history and our historical monuments, because those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And also on the abortion thing, abortion should not be legal. If a drunk driver hits a woman that's pregnant, he's tried for killing two people. So why isn't that doctor and that mom tried for murder when they abort a baby? If the drug problem is that much of a problem, kill the mother. Or all mothers that give birth to drug-addicted babies, maybe they should have complete hysterectomy so they can never get pregnant again.
All right, Michael, some very controversial comments there. Thank you for expressing your opinion to us this morning. This is Eastern Standard and reporters' reaction to anything that Michael said there.
Well, about the monuments, I just want to say that I hear this argument a lot, that we need to, you know, if we take down these monuments, we're doomed to forget history. And, you know, I think for some people, you know, especially the African-American community, they don't look at those monuments as a monument to the struggle and to horrors of slavery. They look at those as honoring people who perpetuated the horrors
and
of
slavery. Enslaved their,
and who
enslaved
their
own families,
their families.
Ancestors.
Yeah. When I went to one of the rallies at the rotunda to take down the monuments, you know, I met a woman there who had done a lot of historical research and discovered, you know, that she was descended from slaves. And so when she looked at that Jefferson Davis statue, she saw something a lot different than the rest of us do. And I think people need to keep that in mind when we're talking about preserving history.
And the other thing, too, particularly here in Kentucky, when I started writing these stories, because I'm not originally from Kentucky, and I looked at the history. I was actually very surprised that even though we frequently say Kentucky was split, it was actually the vast majority of people fought for the Union. So it's also sort of, why aren't there Union soldiers up as well? That's really kind of the true history. What had happened is that after the war, the political sentiment sort of switched to, I would say, more Confederate-leaning ideas. But the vast majority of Kentucky soldiers fought for the Union.
Let me acknowledge an email from Carl, who has written in, back to the issue of pension reform, and we'll kind of end our show on the topic we began with to a great extent. 401k administrators, and this is Carl speaking, 401k administrators and managers make a lot of money investing other people's money. I was wondering if your guests think Governor Bevin is willing to promise to the people of the state of Kentucky that he and any of his hedge fund buddies won't make a dime off this new system.
Actually, I think there's some language in the bill about that. On the other hand, there's a good deal of controversy about a lack of transparency about that, too. This is, I guess, the moral coward's way of saying I can't really answer the question. But there is debate about that very subject.
Yeah, and I know that the plan is going to be different than a traditional 401k. It's actually going to be a 401A, and the employees are going to be required to contribute. They have to. They can't opt out of it. So it's a very different system. It's unclear how that was going to work. I agree with Ronnie. It's hard to tell.
Right, we're about now to wrap up this Reporters Roundtable. The story out there in the news on this Thursday is about House Speaker Jeff Hoover, and we'll be looking for coverage from some of these very folks in the room here about what may happen there and as a result of that report from the Louisville Courier-Journal. What about a special session of the General Assembly? How are we doing on that? When are we going to hear about that? When is the governor going to announce, and when is that going to actually occur to deal with pension reform? What do we know?
We don't know. The governor says very soon, but he's been saying that for a while.
He also says when we're ready. And he also says it doesn't behoove him, it's not to his advantage to say it yet. He has some dates in mind, but he won't say.
Well, and the other issue's got to be he's got to have the votes. And with Hoover, that's the issue. So nobody knows. It wouldn't surprise me if it didn't happen before January.
And so it might end up on the agenda for the 2018 session?
We don't know. I mean, what happens with Hoover, I think, is going to determine an awful lot.
2018 session gets started early in January, and we'll be covering that. Ryland will be covering it for Kentucky Public Radio. Ronnie and Adam, of course, on site in Frankfort. We'll be hearing from WEKU's Stu Johnson, who will be covering the General Assembly this coming year. Going to be an interesting year. A lot of news coming from that, and we hope that you, our listeners, will let us know what you want to hear in the coverage. You'll react to what you are hearing on WEKU and Kentucky Public Radio stations. Thank you all for being here with us. We've had Adam Beam of the Associated Press, who's been with us before. Glad, as always, to have you here. Beth Musgrave joined us for the first time from the Lexington Herald-Leader. I hope you'll come back.
Thanks for having me.
You have added a lot to our conversation, and we're glad to have you with us, Beth. Ryland Barton is on the air every day, pretty much, on WEKU, Kentucky Public Radio State House reporter. Thank you, Ryland, for everything you do for us.
Thanks, John.
And Ronnie Ellis, the dean of our group, so to speak.
The old guy.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're interested in your reactions to anything we do here at WEKU. Please give us a call and leave a message on our voicemail line, 859-622-1657. Send us an email at any time, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST, and we would encourage you to follow the WEKU Eastern Standard Twitter account, as well as a couple of other. We have a news account and a general programming account on Twitter. This program will be available as a podcast this afternoon, likely within the next hour, from WEKU.FM, and will repeat on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thank you for tuning in to Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Thank you.